Okay. So, yeah, did you hear the little thing saying we're being recorded
yeah.
and all? All right,
yeah,
cool. Awesome. Well, I've kind of asked some of these questions already of the idea, but I'm just wondering. Well, first of all, I actually found out during our call and looking into it, like, I was trying to figure out, like, what Let's Organize the Hood. Like, I thought that was kind of the program, but or the name of the organization, but so correct me, it's Black Autonomy, the Black Autonomy Federation, and then Let's Organize the Hood, that's like a program of
yeah,
that.
Yeah, it's the overall program for the group. And
great.
It covers, because it's we're a multi-issue organization.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, Let's Organize the Hood. First, it started out first as a training program.
Mm-hmm.
And we were training, you know, people of color activists all over the United States and then, you know, in Canada too, you know, and over the course of about 15 years, actually. And then later on, after we looked at it and said, well, we could make this into an overall program for everything that we do, you know, and we're still figuring it out, but it has some real serious potential to be, you know, really a massive program.
Mm. Yeah, so could you tell me a little bit about just a little bit more in depth of like what the Let's Organize the Hood program is, and then also about what the Black Autonomy Federation.
Well, Organize the Hood is kind of like something that you organize on your own, in your own community. It won't be the same in every community. Some places, the issue might be unemployment in the Black community, for instance. We thought that was going to be the issue here in Memphis, was going to be massive unemployment and poverty because this is the poorest big city in the country. So far, that has not proven to be the case, though. You know, but we trained people in Detroit who were interested in building a Black-led tenants movement. We trained people in Atlanta, including some activists who came from New Orleans who, you know, had issues that they wanted to deal with around massive unemployment, you know, massive unemployment and then police shootings and all this stuff. Because, you know, we've got experience in grassroots organizing around all of these things, you know. We don't project ourselves as some sort of experts that are over and above the people, but we've got practical experience. We're not putting out any national plan or something or other that we haven't actually done ourselves, you know what I'm saying? That
mm-hmm.
we haven't actually got our hands dirty in doing. So, you know, it's a program that's for the community to take up instead of organizing. Now, organizers might bring it to the community, but the plan is that the organizer will be ultimately removed and the community will run its own program. Because that's the way I was taught in the 1960s with the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, is that you had organizers, and they'd be sent to communities, right? And in the community, though, they would pick out who the leadership was. And then when they would pick out who the leadership was and they would train and develop that leadership, then they would get out of the way and let the people do what they needed, feel like they needed to do. Now, they would be around in case people wanted to ask some questions and, you know, and get some help or something. But basically, the community made all the major decisions, and the community did most of the major work, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is what we're trying to develop here in Memphis. This is something brand new here in Memphis, you know, in the sense that we've only been here, living here a couple of years ourselves, and our program has only been in existence 2 months.
Mm-hmm.
And in 2 months' time, especially once we figured out that the community is – has had a long-running history with the police department. Once we figure that out, you know, we've been able to become the main organization in the entire city dealing with police brutality. There's nobody else doing anything. The so-called civil rights groups and all the rest, and they haven't said anything. The Black preachers, all the groups that, you know, that usually pop up, and they haven't really been saying anything. They've been neutralized completely. But you know, so really, I guess you could say that Let's Organize the Hood is what it's what you want it to be in your community. It's not going. There's no plan that says that you have to organize everything thus and thus and thus. Although there is, and you know, there is a national program. You know, the, you know, I'll just say that. You know, we got areas that we work in, but the community itself, each community, and sometimes even each neighborhood will be able to pick out its own particular program and carry out that as well.
That's what we say. Yeah, you were talking about that kind of leads. One of the things you said was leads into one of my next questions about high levels of police brutality there. Could you tell me a little bit about what is the situation there, the police brutality? The recent shooting of that young man, for instance, yeah. That just happened this week.
Mm-hmm. Well, to really understand why these things happen in Memphis, you really have to look at the political structure here, you know, and go back a little ways. You know, back some years ago, there was because there were so many police shootings of black people here by what was then an openly racist police department, an all-white police department was killing black people, that it actually, including a number of young kids who were shot and killed, there was a case that went to the United States Supreme Court called Tennessee versus Garner. And in that case, what these people had been carrying out was what they called a fleeing felon law or act. And it was a common law act that allowed them to commit massive, deadly force in situations where a person was unarmed and merely trying to elude capture. You know what I'm saying? Well, they could shoot you in the back of the head, and that's what they were doing. And a lot of people were dying in that period here. Memphis was having all kinds of people dying. And so this case went up to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court looked at the situation, and they found that act unconstitutional, and they forbade the Memphis Police Department from using deadly force in a situation where somebody was just trying to elude capture that didn't uh-huh. represent any threat to the public, or violence to the public. Well, now, every person on this list of nine persons who've died this year, every one of those didn't have any weapon whatsoever. Mm-hmm. And five of those were trying to run for their lives from the police shooting at them. And and this young man, in fact, they claim he shot one time, but they admit that at least four bullets went into other people's houses, so they shot him four times at close range. And they refused to let the family see his body because of that. They refused to let the family see his body. They're trying to cover it up. And so if we look at this situation, of the other folks there got shot in February. In February, a young man, 20 years old, was shot in the back, claimed that he was the leader of a car ring or something or other, a car theft ring. And when they ran up on him, whatever the situation was, they shot him in the back. And they admit he didn't have any gun or anything. You know, he was just trying to get in the car and escape. Then you had a case of a young man who was 19 years old. He was they don't call it retardation now, but they call it mentally challenged. But he was mentally challenged, and they claim he ran at six cops with a knife. Now, that's what they claim, that he ran at them with a knife. Now, they knew who this guy was. They knew he was mentally challenged. And they had arrested him 2 months before this and all this kind of stuff. And they shot him, right, shot and killed him. Well, we don't know how many times they shot him. We think they shot him multiple times, but they covered all this stuff up. And now Memphis claims, because of an earlier incident some 20 years ago, they claim that they have a national model for how to deal with mentally challenged people that does not require them to use deadly force. And they claim to have at least 200 officers who were specially trained to deal with defusing such situations. Well, the question is, where were those officers at? Because the police station is right up the hill, within a couple of blocks. And where were these officers at? Any one of them could have, let's say, defused the situation. They were armed with pistols and rifles and all this stuff and had tear gas and all this. So they could have used non-lethal force. They could have just overpowered him. Quite frankly, six cops can do that. But they shot him, and this was intentional. The same night, a white man, he was also, you know, this is an entertainment district down here where this kid was shot. Mm-hmm. There was a white civilian who was arrested. He had an open knife in his back pocket, and they didn't arrest him. They didn't beat him. They didn't do anything. They did arrest him, but they didn't beat him, and they certainly didn't kill him. They just put him in the car and let him, you know, and took him on to the station. So then you had that situation. Then you had another situation, which is really a racist incident, where a black man was apparently in a relationship with a white woman and had her car and was driving around in her car. And she, for whatever reason, told a cop that the car had been stolen. And they went after this guy, even though they knew that the car hadn't been stolen. When they found that out, after they found out the car hadn't been stolen, they went after this guy and started shooting at him and shot and killed him. And they purportedly shot him 32 times. You got these situations on and on, then they got two other people that they choked to death, the two other people who were in police custody. One guy was arrested at his, July 3rd, he was arrested at a party, July 4th. And he was dragged out by six cops, and all of a sudden he turns up dead. Choked to death, essentially. And they cover that up. They won't release the autopsy reports. So part of our struggle is to make them do it. And then you had two people killed here in a so-called automobile accident with the police officer. This guy was driving at 101 miles per hour. He didn't have any running lights, the blue running lights. He didn't have any siren or anything. He just running at 100 miles an hour up and down the street and just ran into some people and killed them. Kill a 13-year-old girl and kill, the driver was a 54-year-old woman. They were going to a birthday party. He just ran to him and killed him. Now, this is the third such case of what's essentially a vehicular homicide, the third one by a cop in the last 5 years. So, it's not like they're learning something, So, all in all, these cases that that you can point to, every one of these people were unarmed. One guy sleeping in his car, and how do you get killed for sleeping in your car? And they beat on the door, woke him up, and they say he jumped up, and he jumped out of the car. Now, listen to this story. He jumped out of the car, and he grappled with six cops, and they couldn't restrain him. And he jumped back in the car, and he started his engine, and he was dragging a cop, and therefore they had to shoot and kill him. Now, this is their story. And, it really doesn't matter to them what they tell us, essentially. Mm-hmm. From their standpoint. So this is the kind of thing that goes on. But Memphis has had a long history of it, going back to 1983 when they killed seven young black men over a minor incident. This group, who was a so-called MOVE-type organization. You familiar with MOVE in Philadelphia?
Yeah.
It's, this is supposedly a MOVE-type organization, according to the cops. And so they set up an incident where they had some police go to the door claiming that somebody had stolen something. And then the cop pulled out a gun and tried to force his way in the place. And this caused a fight in the place. And then they encircled the place and claimed they were holding the cop hostage, this and that and the other. And they came in there and shot that place up and shot and killed everybody. And they just executed them. They shot everybody in the head. They claimed they had a bunch of guns in there. They had one gun that they took from the cop, allegedly, and they came in and shot every one of those men in the back of the head, every one of them, So that's the situation, and the FBI and all of them came in and covered it up and so on. So this is what accounts for this kind of police terrorism in this town that has gone on years and years and years, And we are organizing on a grassroots level. Essentially, we are the first group to be doing this in 20-some years, apparently. This is astounding to us that the thing could be this way. But the civil rights groups have been neutralized by the election of a black mayor and also by money and status and all this kind of thing, And they really, at least in some places, they will come out and they will demonstrate at least. Might not like the militancy of their demonstrations, but at least they will come out. They will acknowledge that there has been a shooting or killing, that the community is questioning. Nothing from the NAACP, nothing from the Southern Christian Leadership Council that we call the Southern Christian Liars Club. Nothing from these groups, So we are essentially, we didn't intend to get involved in this struggle. We, you know, it wasn't the issue that we had picked. It wasn't the issue that we thought we were going to be organizing around. But we've been pushed into it, and we're the only force right now doing anything.
I know on September 8th there was a rally in March to address this, at least the police brutality. So I was just wondering a little bit, how that went, what the turnout was like, what happened, and with that and other work that's been going on since then, how you see this movement against police brutality moving forward in Memphis and then throughout the state.
Well, it's interesting. We did have people from other cities come to the event, or at least in Chattanooga, which is that's my hometown, and it's like some 5 hours away or something like 3 to 5 hours away. And so we did have people come from there, and there is talk now of building a statewide movement. But the demonstration itself was fantastic. If you consider the fact that what the media here does is they don't report on anything that we do, anything that we say. We're persona non grata. They're extremely hostile, opposed to us. And, I mean, it's like if we give a press conference, nobody comes, that kind of thing. I think one media source does come. He's pretty sympathetic. He comes. And none of the other stations even report on it. So if you consider all that's been going on, this media whiteout that's been going on for quite some time, for us to get 70 people based on our own work in our own network just with flyers, that is absolutely phenomenal. You know what I'm saying? Now, I've been in many demonstrations where we've had more people, not here, but I mean, in Chattanooga and other places, we regularly had demonstrations of, several hundred people, In fact, even in Kalamazoo, Michigan, which is a little town in comparison to Memphis, we had 100 people at a demonstration where we protested the jailings of black men naked. We protested that, and we had 100 people that went to City Hall. So getting 70 here is sad in one sense, if you look at the size of the city. But on the other hand, since nothing has been happening, and they've been blocking everything we can do in terms of the media, that's a phenomenal turnout.
Mm-hmm.
And people were really militant, and they took over the center of the city and marched all the way from and went to the police station and got in front of the police station where they came out and killed this kid, and then all these so-called tough guy cops are at, cowboy cops. And we got out in front of there and had a demonstration in front of there, and they would not come out. They would not come out at all. And this is the place where they're quick to beat you up. You can go to YouTube and you can see videos where they've beaten women up, beating children up, beating all kind of people up. And but they would not come out, to face us. And so we marched on to City Hall and went through the center of the city, the tourist district, and shook them to that was really funny, And we went on had a rally, a 2-hour rally at City Hall. So and this forced the media to come out. It forced them to come out, forced them to report on us. They wanted to put a lot of negative stuff, talk about my background as a revolutionary, talk about my wife's background as in the Black Panther Party, talk about, the fact I was a political prisoner, this, that, and the other. But the fact that they had to report on people protesting, it really broke, it really shook them up. And it let people see the potential, and that there are people who are willing to protest, who fight, willing to fight police brutality in this city.
Mm-hmm.
So in essence, it was a real important thing. Yes, we're going to try to build a statewide movement. We have made contacts already. We're going to become part of the October 22nd coalition here. There's not a coalition, but the October 22nd event, we're going to have one here for the first time. And, we're going to use that event to raise the case of Justin Thompson, the 15-year-old kid who was killed, and all of those who've died in police custody. We're going to raise their cases.
Sorry, I just wondering, could you just talk just a bit about what is the October 22nd?
The October 22nd movement was actually created about 16 years ago, and I'm not formally a part of it, and I'm, But it was created 16 years ago. I think it was 1996 when they created it, something like that. And they created it to deal with police brutality, attacks all over the country, to try to, I guess, to try to bring together a coalition of forces. And they've been having these demonstrations every year since that time, you know, and it's just a one-day affair. But it's the recognized National Day of Action Against Police Brutality in the United States. The October 22nd Coalition was originally, I think, one of the Revolutionary Communist Party or something or other. And but it's grown past that one organization. It's grown past so that many of the people who are part of it now have, you know, no ties really to the RCP. They have just, you know, decided to have events on their own so that, you know, they can connect with other people who are doing it all over the country. And so this is what we are doing. We're going to raise the cases in our community about what are happening. We're going to try to get people here to be part of it, to educate people about the importance of it, you know. And we're going to go from there. What we ultimately want to do, to tell you the truth, is to build a mass movement large enough and with these cases to try to publicize it enough so that they're almost on the level of a Trayvon Martin case.
Yeah.
And we want to try to get a national march against police brutality.
Mm-hmm.
We in Washington D.C. A national march, because that has never happened here in this country, and it needs to happen. You know, it needs to happen. So this is what one of the things we're trying to do. We're trying to push towards that. It's, you know, really important that people who had loved ones die, whether it was last week or whether it was years ago, that they not give up the fight. You know, we had a woman in a wheelchair, someone I used to work with, by the way, in a wheelchair, came from Chattanooga, Tennessee, to Memphis. Like I said, it was about 5 hours away by car. Came to the event and had somebody pushing her around, you know what I'm saying? And this was not a motorized wheelchair, by the way. You know, but she wanted to be a part of this campaign because she believed so much. Her father had been murdered in 1983, and she founded the Concerned Citizens for Justice that I became the president of there, that led a 15-year campaign against police terrorism. And we were at one stage one of the most advanced political formations against police brutality in the country, you know, because our thing was protests as opposed to, you know, lobbying or all this kind of stuff,
mm-hmm.
or you know, lobbying the federal government. I mean, pressure should be put on the federal government, true enough, but we don't believe in lobbying politicians and the politicians should run our agenda and all that. You know, Jesse Jackson, celebrity, so-called leaders, and all this kind of thing. We're trying to build a grassroots movement from the bottom up, you know. And this is what we're about.
Yeah, that leads me into one of my questions. And if you felt like you kind of already answered that, I was just wondering a little bit more. I first became aware of your work. Sometime this summer, I ran across the letter that you wrote about the poor people's survival movement and the need to eventually create self-sufficient communities and bioregional federations.
Right.
I was wondering if you could tell me a little bit more about that.
Well, you know, we've always taken the position of grassroots community organizing. And, you know, so that's a logical next step, is to then talk about how do we build a community or series of communities that's not beholden to the existing government or the existing city apparatus or what have you. How do we build that? How do we turn neighborhoods and communities into communes, you know, self-governing like communes? And so the thinking about all this, you know, has gone on for years and years, and they're talking about it and organizing around it. And it looks like this is really a time when it could happen, because there's widespread disaffection with the whole process of representative government, you know, widespread criticism. People have lost faith in the, you know, the so-called representative democracy type of government. So the idea is that on the local level, people would start to build their own neighborhood government. They'd build their own neighborhood institutions. They'd even start to deal with, you know, community control of the police and building the day to have their own independent neighborhood militias or neighborhood self-defense forces to deal with our own social problems. You know what I'm saying? So that the city and all these racist vigilantes and the rest of these people calling themselves police officers wouldn't be in the community to kill people and shoot people down in this kind of situation. But, you know, you have to – there's a number of things. This is a broad subject. You have to talk about how do you take a community which is extremely impoverished. How do you then take that community and deal with the human capital and deal with creating some kind of economic base where people can be given jobs or can build housing and these things for themselves. Now, I'm not saying that they should not pressure the government for resources, but what I am saying is that we have to recognize that we've got really abundance of human capital and other forms of it that we can use in its stead, you know what I'm saying, so that we're not totally beholden to it. One of the things we were trying to develop in Chattanooga over the course of some time when Black Autonomy was there was a black community bond, we call it, which was a complementary currency, so that we would take get you know, cash money reserves and put it in an institution, and we would give them this bond. It would, you know, it worked just like a regular municipal bond would. We'd be able to use that to build things, you know what I'm saying, and to deal with housing issues and all these kind of questions. Of course, we weren't able to take it to its fullest extent, though, because we were, you know, prosecuted by the government and harassed and all this kind of thing.
Yeah, I'm wondering within that, if, you know, the idea down the line with this, when you're having the means to, you know, doing things like growing food and because, I mean, I've been thinking a lot about, well, you know, just the understanding of the how fragile our food system is, and that part of that is, you know, bringing that power back to people to grow their own food and have their own livestock, what have you. I don't know if there is any, I just was interested to hear your thoughts
urban
on that.
Urban food production is a survival program. We've always recognized it as a survival program. And we had been doing urban farming, especially around Chattanooga and other places. We've been doing urban farming and other cities where we've been. And we've been doing urban farming and trying to understand urban farming and trying to understand the skills and all these things and link all these things together. You know, the food production linked together the fact that, you know, we got to deal with massive unemployment. We've got to deal, you know, with all of those kinds of issues that are killing us. Here in Memphis, Memphis is the city that has the largest number of infant mortality cases among black infants. It's the city that has the largest number of black women dying from cancer of the breast, and it's the largest number. It's the poorest big city according to the United States Department of Bureau of Census. I'm sorry. It's the poorest big city in the country, and there's just on and on and on these sort of what you call social disparities, where Memphis leads the nation in it because of long years of economic segregation, and also years of police terrorism, and all these things linked together. You know what I'm saying? And so, when you build this, you can't just concentrate on, well, we're going to grow food. You have to also be organizing around issues of, you know, police terrorism. You have to organize around issues where people are disempowered, you know, in the institutions that exist now. you got to organize around a lot of different issues. You got to build a whole synthesis, you know, instead of just one single issue thing that you're focusing on. Even though at this stage, we're dealing with, say, for instance, police terrorism, we came into existence, actually, to deal with a number of issues. One of them was the massive imprisonment of black youth. One of them was to deal with massive unemployment and poverty. And really, this whole issue that we're dealing with now was the one thing that nobody was wanting to deal with. But, you know, that's just the way things. I mean, they were stacking up bodies so quickly we couldn't ignore that.
Yeah.
But the whole question of a bioregional area as opposed to just a city, we cannot think and be limited to what the state says is the territorial limitations of an area. We need to be able to turn land, even take land from landowners or the rich people, take that land from corporations, and use that to grow. Even in Chicago, we started to do that. Because in the city of Chicago, there's all these plots of land, buildings been torn down and all this stuff, and it's just there. Nobody's using it for anything. So we started to just take it over. First they said, well, we're going to give you permission. I said, well, you don't have to give us permission. We're just going to go ahead and take it, you know. So, I mean, you know, it's a fight. I mean, it really is a fight. And, you know, it isn't always dramatic. A lot of times people don't even hear about it. Most of the stuff we did, you know, we didn't get any massive publicity for it and all that kind of thing, you know. And like I said, every city has been different. Even the cities that we've organized in, you know, me personally and then when I got, you know, with my wife and so forth, the cities we've organized in, the campaigns have been different. You know, the issues have been different, all of that. And the expectations of people and their understanding have been different, you know.
Yeah.
So that's why we had to organize a totally independent movement here.
Yeah. So is the idea of the Black Economy Federation to spend, I'm just trying to understand, like, for some members, spending the time, as you said, to organize, to help to organize people or people you see as leaders in that community to with, you know, certain knowledge and skills, and then to move to other areas and to do that.
This is essentially what we've been doing, actually, you know, because we just came, we were in Nashville before this. We were in Nashville, which we were organizing around there, around a number of different issues. We were in Chicago, around a, you know, kind of a diverse movement. We were in, before that, we were in Indiana. I'm sorry, not Indiana, but Michigan, Kalamazoo, Michigan, Southwest Michigan, I should say. And then in Chattanooga. So we've been in a number of different cities organizing. At one stage, in the earlier stage, when we first got started in the early 1990s, mid to late 1990s, actually, we were in 10 cities, you know, 10, 12 cities, something like that, all at one time. The whole idea of creating a national movement that doesn't deal with creating a local movement first is that it's unsustainable. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And when people, what the reality is that when people see that you have a sustainable movement, wherever you started at, it can spread. People will emulate it. People will take it up. You know what I'm saying? And that's essentially what happened to Black Panther Party. They didn't try to build a national movement. They started, you know, in the San Francisco Bay Area, you know, especially in Oakland, and it just spread. I mean, it was popularized, you know, through TV and different things, but it wasn't what was planned. It just spread, and sometimes that's the way things have to be. That's why we're concentrating on Memphis. We're not telling anybody that we're running all over the country and doing. I'm not saying we won't help somebody start one, you know, or start a camp, you know, a movement somewhere else, but our objective is right now is to worry about Memphis.
Yeah.
You know, Memphis has got, I mean, you know, to be quite honest, we live here, and we didn't move here for this purpose, quite honestly, but while we're here, we see these things, and we got pushed into a lot of stuff. You know, and that's what happens a lot of times. You don't, I'm the leader. You can follow me. We don't work like that. We don't work like that at all, you know. And what we try to do is develop people, develop other people, so that they can take on leadership roles.
Mm-hmm.
You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And that's real important. That's real important. Otherwise, you have a cult. You know, you just have a cult. Everybody follows one guy or two people or whatever, and you know, nobody else can say anything, and nobody else can do anything, you know, and nobody's being trained to do anything.
Yeah. Well, one of my next questions is, so you've written about, you know, the importance of supporting people of color in dismantling white supremacist institutions. However, as we know, unfortunately, most of the American white left, for the American white left, especially, I can speak, you know, being sort of, I don't like to limit it to that, but the environmental kind of that fight and that struggle, you see that as well. Very that the struggles of working class people of color are, it's either unknown or they don't consider it a priority. What would you say to those on the left who pay lip service to either liberation or ending oppressive systems, and don't seem to have a focus at all on race, and also those who pay lip service to anti-racism but seem dismayed at the prospect of making connections with communities of color?
Well, I think that those people have to, first of all, those groups and individuals, and they have to be challenged by peoples of color, organized in their own autonomous movements, even if it's semi-autonomy within another organization. They have to be organized in numbers enough to challenge these people and to challenge this movement and to change the direction of the movement. You know, you're fighting for the heart and soul of the movement is what it is. And so that's the first thing. But, you know, generally, if you make a broad theoretical analysis, you would have to say that, you know, these movements are corrupt. They will not result in a it won't result in a revolution, and it won't result in one for sure that benefits black people. I've criticized the Occupy movement because it's a white middle class movement whose only concerns and always have been around white people. Now there's somebody say, well, there's black people in this. That doesn't mean anything because you got black people in something. It's whether or not they have a voice, whether they have any power to dictate policies and that sort of thing. You know what I'm saying? And if they don't have that, and if they're just a puppet organization or a puppet group of people that they can trot out and say, here's our blacks, you know, if it's that kind of thing, we call that a progressive plantation. That's what that is, a progressive plantation. And that is a very dangerous development. That's a very dispiriting development for the people who are in those groups, and it's very disempowering. And it's just, this is how the white left generally, over the course of years, has operated. They bring in a few blacks, might even put them up front to be visible, but they don't have any power whatsoever. They're puppets, and they are not respected in communities of color, you know, which is why the white left has never really made any real serious inroads. And but it's real important at this period, and it's been at every historical period, but especially right now, is that, you know, people have to understand that racism is not going to go away. Racism is not going to be defeated on its own. It has to be challenged. And you have to challenge. I don't care what anyone says about what they stand for, or some white radicals claim. We used to call them mother country radicals back in the day, you know. That's what we used to call them. That's what the Black Panther Party used to call them, mother country radicals. You look at some of the speeches of Huey P. Newton especially, this is what he would say, you know. And they have, you know, privileges, even the ones claimed to be broke. They have privileges vis-a-vis community of color groups and communities, you know what I'm saying? And they will generally use that to try to neutralize or weaken any criticism of them or any kind of autonomous movement from becoming very powerful. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. They were happy when the Black Panther Party was attacked and destroyed, and they didn't try to help it. They didn't try to fight back fascism. They didn't try to do that. Their whole thing was to profit from the death of the Black Panther Party by getting all of their cadre and all of the, you know, community supporters that they could get to become part of their movement, you see. And this has historically been the case, you know, coming down over the years since the 1960s especially. This has essentially been what you saw. In the 1960s, what you really saw, and even in the 1950s, what you really saw develop was a black autonomous movement. And that movement came into existence. I don't mean black autonomy such as, you know, I was involved with later, but I'm saying that was an autonomous movement of black people, working class black people, that was able to challenge white supremacy in the South, and later when black power came into existence, able to challenge white supremacy and capitalism, you know, corporate capitalism, throughout the country. You see what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
And so it's important to understand that, and compare that period and compare the fight against racism during that period. Well, what's happening now? You know, what's happening? You don't have any so-called anti-racist movement. You got white people that want to talk about right-wingers and what the right-wingers are doing, but they don't want to talk about their own internal racism and their own internal white supremacy. You see what I'm saying? And how they're related to the state and how they, in fact, nonprofit organizations, white-led nonprofit organizations, are the money launderers for capitalism. Every so often I put that up on Facebook, and people have started to admit that much of the corporate money, especially in this period, they're not putting corporate money, it's just that Citizens United decision, into necessarily these PACs. They're putting tons of money into white-led nonprofit organizations because they don't have any restrictions on them. You see what I'm saying? And so we're talking about that kind of corruption. And then you got the kind of racist garbage on the inside of it, where they're using that to try to stifle autonomous black tendencies, or they're going to stifle tendencies of color. You see what I'm saying? So what people of color movements have to do is to understand this whole thing about decolonization, which is an important concept, but it has to be taken further than just trying to get the white folks to stop being racist. Or to try to get the white folks to recognize, you know, Indian claims or something like that. It has to be understood that we're trying to dismantle this entire society, this entire capitalist system, and the whole system of white supremacy worldwide. This is what we're trying to do, you know. And so it's real important to understand that. And then we'll be successful, you know. Otherwise, we will be strictly on the defensive from white folks feeling guilty over what kind of crimes they've done and continue to perpetrate.
That reminds, you know, I'm wondering what your thoughts are in the age of Obama. Do you think, you know, from the work that you're doing, do you feel like that, you know, that this is a common tactic that, you know, white power structure uses, and that, you know, picking someone, you know, that is a woman or is black or what have you, and to make us think we're in a post-patriarchal or a post-racist society.
Yeah,
do you feel like that has played a role in neutralizing or suppressing resistance in communities of color? And, you know, from, you know, it sounds like with the work that you're doing, people are fighting back, things are beginning to happen. Or so do you feel like it's played a role in neutralizing resistance, or do you feel like a lot of people are seeing right through it and the ploy isn't working?
Well, I think that it has been effective for quite some time. I think we call it black faces in high places, or you can substitute brown faces or whatever. And essentially what that is a form of neo-colonialism where they put a black stooge or a brown stooge or other person of color in a position of authority, alleged authority. to be administrators for this system. And there, you know, this happened. You got to put this within context of how and when this happened. And this happened at the end of the 1960s and early stages of the 1970s, when the Black Power movement, when all these other groups, you know, of peoples of color were being defeated. And when they were defeated, they weren't just destroyed. The leaderships weren't just killed or imprisoned. They actually went after the minds of the people too, because they wanted the masses of people to think that, you know, these people, some of whom were ex-activists and were selling out, they wanted to think that somehow we've now reached the stage where we've arrived and we're enjoying the benefits of, you know, of our anti-racist movement, of long-standing, the civil rights and so forth, Black Power movement. And what we really have seen is just a new kind of, what we saw was a new kind of retrenchment of middle-class forces going into the academy, going into the institutions, the corporations, or going into the government. And, you know, we went from seeing, for instance, something like 40 black officials nationwide in the 50s and in the early 1960s, and after the 1964 Voting Rights Act, you had, you know, several thousand people of color now inhabiting, you know, political positions. You had hundreds of mayors and all this kind of stuff. So it was really designed from the beginning. They tried to figure out, how can we deal with Black Power? How can we deal with all these mass movements of people of color? How are we going to deal with this? And so what they decided to do was to neutralize them with their own people, and to do the same kind of neocolonialism that they've done in Africa, that they've done in Latin America and other parts of the world. And so this is what this whole thing was. And Nixon came, of all people, Richard Nixon, who was president then in 1968, he actually came up with this whole question of the black entrepreneur and green money and all this kind of stuff. And his whole idea was, we're going to give them grants, we'll give them payoffs, we'll give them whatever we want. We're going to split them that way. We'll find the ones that will sell out, and the hardcore, the ones who won't sell out, we'll put them in prison, we'll kill them, we'll do whatever we need to do. And this is essentially what happened. So, you know, myself, I was one of those that, you know, was essentially driven to prison, you know. And you know, some of my comrades and other people I knew were hunted down and killed. Then you had people, many of whom are still in prison today, have been there for 30 some years. So it's all been a campaign. And so now we get to Obama, who's now the president. We've taken it to a logical extent, you know, where it is designed and it is used to neutralize any protest in the street. Now, I'm going to tell you something. Everywhere else in the world, people are fighting tooth and nail against austerity measures. Even the discussion by politicians of implementing austerity measures started mass protests in France, started mass protests in Greece and everywhere else, just the discussion of it. You know, what they got was effectively was Social Security, and they were talking about forcing people to work longer, you know, work from, instead of being able to retire at 60 years old or 62, they're going to have to work until 65 or 67. They actually rebel in the streets. Hundreds of thousands of people rebel in the streets over that. They said that in the United States, nobody did anything or said anything. They said, well, we'll vote them out. So all of this belief, there's a mysticism about the electoral system and all this stuff that doesn't exist in a lot of places. They see right through it. Now, people are starting to see through it here. They're going to have to see through it more. You know what I'm saying? But there are millions of people that are still brainwashed that Obama is somehow going to deliver something to them.
Mm-hmm. Or that he's going to be better. You know, a lot of people that I've talked to, well, they'll admit that Obama has been disappointing in many areas. Not closing Guantanamo, drone strikes, wars in Africa, and what have you. Indefinite detention of U.S. citizens. He's really trying to push through for, you know, just to throw out some examples, but it still seems to be the mindset that, well, he's going to be a lot better than Romney, and it'll be the lesser of two evils, and that this will be a stalling, or some other people, it's a stalling tactic before things get really bad, or, you know, that, or that Obama will be a gentler form of fascism.
Yeah.
If anything,
well,
and I've thought about that and wrestled with that to myself.
Mm-hmm.
But then thinking about it, you know, I've been going back and forth on this. Well, in the sense it is the more effective, in that people are not going to speak out and are not going to go to the streets because this idea, well, it's not as bad. Or sometimes, someone who's black and.
Mm-hmm.
Talk in a soothing voice that, you know, people, you know, are not as angered. So I would just kind of hear your thoughts on that.
Well, I think that there's a great deal of confusion. I do think there's anger. But I think that the anger is internalized as rather than that you see it in the streets. I think that Obama is a pacification agent. He was elected to be a pacification agent. To neutralize any grassroots protest. The left in this country, or at least the grassroots movement in this country, was becoming dangerously large as far as they were concerned, and they wanted to push people back into the Democratic Party fold. See, it's important to have the Democratic Party because it allegedly is the so-called party of the people and the unions and all this other kind of stuff. It's a liberal reform party. But they had to posture with Obama. They had to bring something. They needed Obama more than he needed them, really. And big corporate money went into getting him elected. The Soros Foundation and all these people, they actually put Obama in office. The liberal wing of the capitalist class, you know, put that money in to put him in office. So they see that there's a need for him. Now, what Romney represents, I call Romney raw money. That's what I call him, raw money. And he represents the extreme right wing of capital, the extreme reactionary wing of capital. And these people, they want to have the state run directly by corporations. They want the corporations to run the state. They want a fascist corporate state.
Yeah.
And it is substantially different from what Obama and them want. They want to continue on with what they're doing. They also want to serve the corporations. They just want to serve them in a different way. You see what I'm saying? They want to serve them that in a way that even though he has been signing up for the NDAA and all this other stuff, he will use it, he says, sparingly, you know. He promises, you know what I'm saying? Whereas Romney is a straight-up fascist, and he tell you he is. He wants to put corporations in total command of the economy. He wants to create a corporate state. We need to understand, though, that neither one of these guys really represent the interests of working class and poor people.
Yeah.
That they both are agents of corporations. And it doesn't matter whether it's the left. There's this corporate feud or this inter-capitalist feud where they decide whether or not they're going to, you know, they fight over which policy they're going to adopt. Neither one of those policies that they adopt is in our best interest. You know what I'm saying? And they know this, and they'll sit down there and laugh about it at some stage. I beat you that time, raw money. You know, you get the next one, so-and-so. You know, they'll talk about this because they know that they're both serving the same people. And those people are not people down in projects. They're not people in, you know, in college dormitories. They're not people, you know, on the bottom. They're not all common people like us. They are the elite. And I do think that it was a great thing that the Occupy movement came and started, you know, raising that issue. It's just that they didn't go to the logical extent. And they didn't attempt to bring in voices that have never been heard before, you know, out of the hood and out of people of color community. They didn't bring those voices. We were not part of the discussion. We were not seen as being an important enough base for them to go and try to recruit us. You know what I'm saying? So that and when people do that to you, to me, it is the worst kind and the worst bootlicking, to go begging to become part of their movement. You know,
yeah.
It's bootlicking. It's treachery. And so what I tried to do, you know, was try to encourage people of color in, you know, in the Occupy movement and others to start looking really at organizing your own movement, because this thing is going to collapse. It's unsustainable. And that's what I see happening right now. It is collapsing. It is weakening despite what they're saying. They're not able to do the things they were doing before. Some cities, they're doing nothing. Like in Memphis, they don't do anything here. And there's just white folks meeting around a campfire and all this kind of stuff. They're in bed with the politicians. The politicians, they didn't even attack them here and drive them away like they did everybody else. They said they're just so inane. They're not doing nothing. Just leave them there and let them have campfires and get drunk down there, whatever they want to do.
Yeah.
That's really sad.
Like you're saying with the, I mean, what you're saying with the, you know, it is collapsing, the global economic system is collapsing, and then now this is coinciding with ecological collapse all throughout the world. I mean, all of these issues are
they're linked. See, they're smoking the planet. The politicians and the corporations are smoking the planet.
Yep.
And they're doing it in a way that they want to, and see that they can, wipe out a considerable segment of the population.
Mm.
They'll kill off the ability to have crops. I mean, much of the things that we've been talking about are really survival programs. They're not seen, they're not popular at this point, because people still see supermarkets and all this other kind of stuff.
Yeah.
But at some stage, they're going to have to be dealt with, you know, because they are going to create a situation that's so unsustainable that we will not be able to eat their garbage food. We will not be have access to their capital reserves. We will not be able to have, you know, our lives are going to drastically change, you know. We might not even have electricity. Who knows? But we will not have the things that that the petrol-funded and the petrol-fueled economy has created for us. You know, without petroleum, with, you, as you know, without petroleum, this whole thing is going to collapse anyway.
Yep.
So I mean, but from the standpoint of people of color, we have to have our own agenda. We have to be autonomous enough to have our own agenda and our own political program. Even if we work with you know, white movements or other people of color movements and so forth, in we need to have our own agenda. We have to make sure we have our own agenda. We can't let white middle class people set an agenda for people who've been historically oppressed in a different fashion. You know, we can't allow that. That won't save us at all. And you see how much they care about saving you with the Occupy movement. It's just a perfect example. They don't even pretend that they're in sympathy with the black struggle or with the struggle of people of color. They don't even pretend.
Well, that kind of leads into my last question for this interview. What can people do to support your efforts, the efforts of many of you in Memphis, in regards to for the recent case of the death that just happened of that young man, police brutality in general, and just any you know other issues that are in that community? What can people do to support in the efforts, the work that you all are doing?
Yeah. Well, one I suppose is you know, since you don't have to live in Memphis to be concerned with what's happening in Memphis, just any more than you had to live in Sanford, Florida, to be concerned about what's happening with, you know, Trayvon Martin. And we're actually people. We want people to write to the mayor of the city, for instance, and complain about these killings, and especially this recent killing of this young kid. We're going to put more information up about that. We're going to put a website up about it. So the mayor, his email address is mayor at Memphis, Tennessee, or Memphis TN, I'm sorry, MemphisTN.gov. Mayor at memphistn.gov. And you should bombard that guy's mailbox, because his thing is, the only thing he cares about, he doesn't care about people's lives. All he cares about is tourism. And you should let him know that, you know, I'm not coming to Memphis to give you any money. Coming there, mm-hmm. if necessary, to come to protest or something. You know what I'm saying? Your policy is resulting in so many people being killed.
A.C. Wharton?
A.C. Wharton is his name.
Black man.
Yeah, he's black, allegedly. And his phone number, let me see if I got it here, still available, Wharton's phone number. It's, you got it on the website, right? Because I'm not looking at the website.
What website?
Yeah, okay, the mayor's phone number is 901-576-6000.
Okay.
901-576-6000.
Great.
And the cops, and we're going to have a demonstration. Our demonstration, the next demonstration is going to be directly against the cops in City Hall as well, because mm-hmm. they're in close proximity to each other. And you can call the cops. 901-636-3700.
Okay.
901. Okay. And you can make a complaint to the so-called police chief about, you know, Tony Armstrong about his reign of terror and his corrupt police force. I mean, it's really a national issue, you know, that we're suffering from here. All of our lives are in danger in this place. These people are insane. They're shooting people in the back, walking down the street. And, I mean, some people haven't died, have been shot here as well. You should be aware of that. We don't know the actual figures, but there have been people who've been shot and beaten. Women who've been raped, there have been widespread rapes. They got several police officers on trial right now for rape. You got some officers on trial for prostitution that have been running prostitutes across the state line, and drug dealers. In fact, this last killing, we were advised, was as a result of this cop being a drug enforcer and pickup man of money, you know, of drug money. And, he's killed another person before he, you know, killed this kid in 2009. So he's a treacherous individual. But they've covered this up. And this is the kind of stuff that goes on around here. I'm not saying there's not corruption in other cities. I'm saying this is the most corrupt city in the country.
Well, Lorenzo, I'm going to end the recording part of this interview right now. I'd like to talk to you just a little bit after I stop recording. But yeah, thank you so much for spending your time talking to me and doing that and words and everything you had to say. I really appreciate it.
Well, I hope you got something out of it, you know, and I hope I answered your questions.
It was great. Okay, I'm just going to end this interview right now. One second.